everyone, and welcome to Minute 60 of Season 3 of Movie Rob Minutes, the daily podcast where we yippee-ki-yay our way through the 1988 Bruce Willis action flick Die Hard, 1 minute at a time. I'm Rob, and today I'm finishing off my remote journey in Baltimore. But, you know, my host and slash guest has been very gracious the entire week. He's treated me really well. Hopefully he feels that I've been a good guest/host. So we'll see if he invites me back in the future. That we'll have to see. But, well, you know, today's the last day. But so once again, thank you to Nick Rehack from formerly of French Toast Sunday for letting me stay here all week.
Yeah, absolutely. It's been an absolute pleasure. And I'm not going to lie, I'm bummed that this is the last one for this particular movie. But I look forward to ones in the future.
Yeah, but sure. You get a birthday on Sunday, so you're good.
That is true. That is very much true.
You know, I leave, but you still get a birthday.
It's so there true. You go. I get to just eat all weekend, have a lot of cake. A lot of cake. More there cake than I should.
Okay. But, you know, it's your birthday.
That's true.
Why not?
I can cry if I want to.
All right. So, Minute 60 begins with McClane making a smart alecky mark and ends with John looking behind himself. So, basically, we ended things yesterday with Hans getting frustrated that someone is actually using the walkie-talkie, and then we find out that the person who's using the walkie-talkie is actually McClane, who at first apologizes in a very insincere way, and basically says, "Oh, I'm very sorry, Hans. I didn't get that message. Maybe you should have put it on the bulletin board." "I figured, since I waxed Tony and Marco and his friend here, I figured you and Carl and Franco might be a little lonely, so I want to give you a call." So I love the way that he's, you know, giving them all of his information. He's not holding any cards to himself. He's like, "All right, there's this, there's that, the other thing. You know, this is what's going on. I know who you are. I know the names." But I think at the same point, Hans realizes what he's doing. You know, that of the information that he's giving him all of the information.
Yeah.
You know, I love how he calls Heinrich and his friend here. You know, he doesn't know who it is.
His little buddy that came along with him. I think it's just a confidence thing, and it's almost arrogance, because he wants them to know, like, "Hey, I'm ruining this for you. Like, I'm doing better than you. You are going to lose."
Right. But I love the fact also that you know, you can see that he hasn't lost his sense of humor.
That's true.
You know, no matter everything that John has gone through, you know, he still, his sense of humor has remained intact.
Mm. Mm-hmm.
You know, he's talking about, he's talking about everybody. He's talking about a bulletin board. So what do you know about bulletin boards?
I have one at work. Well, we have a lot of whiteboards at work.
Right.
We have a couple of the cork boards where you post up things like that. I have a particular bulletin board that I call my learning board. I put out fun facts, not fun facts, but on this day in history,
which I saw just a few weeks ago. It's great.
It's pretty nice, right?
Yeah. You do that every day?
Every day I'm at work, I put one up.
So you spend like an hour of them paying you for work to write up everything that goes on that day?
Roughly 30 minutes, but I'm also salaried. So, you know, depending on how long my day is, sometimes it's like I'm getting paid for it, sometimes it's like I'm not.
Okay.
In it for the love of the game.
Hey, why not?
Yeah. Outside of them just being used for displaying information and letting people learn stuff, I got nothing.
Okay. All right, so a bulletin board is also known as a pin board or a notice board, right? And it's a surface intended for posting public messages, for example, to advertise items wanted or for sale, announcing events, provide information. Bulletin boards are often made of materials such as cork to facilitate addition and removal of messages, as well as a writing surface such as a blackboard or a whiteboard.
Mm-hmm.
A bulletin board which combines a pin board and writing surface is known as a combination bulletin board.
Makes sense.
Bulletin boards can also be entirely in the digital domain and placed on computer networks so people can leave and erase messages for other people to read and see, as in the bulletin board system. You know, I remember back in the old days of computers, you know, you would post things on the bulletin board, you know, which was a place that you can go and see.
Almost like a message board.
It's a message board, exactly. Yeah. They're used quite often in universities. They're used by sports groups. and extracurricular groups, and a lot of times you'd have them in shops that want to, you know, soup of the day and stuff mm-hmm, like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, I think nowadays it's more prevalent to be using whiteboards for those type of things to make sure things a little bit easier. But
less chalk dust on your allergies and health. And
right. Well, no, they usually would put stuff on the
push pins. Yeah.
No, but that, I'm assuming they also had chalkboards with that type of stuff too. Okay. So when do you think the first modern blackboard was created?
I'm going to go...
So here we are back to talking about chalk.
Yeah.
Because it's the same type of idea, you know.
I want to dip into the BCs, but I think I'm going to go a little bit before that. I'm going to say like 300.
No, I'm talking about modern.
Modern?
Go to modern.
Okay. Let's go 1901.
Wow. It's 1801, but that's, you got the 01 right. You got the 01 right, even though it's 100 years earlier. You got the 01. I'll take it.
There you go. Get a half point.
So a headmaster and teacher named James Pillins, who was teaching in high school in Edinburgh, Scotland.
Oh, okay.
He's credited with inventing the first modern blackboard. Okay. In 1925, a man named George Brooks of Topeka, Kansas, was issued the patent for the use of a corkboard as a bulletin board, where you could stick text into it.
Huh.
Okay. The patent for his invention, which would become a mainstay in homes and offices around the world, expired in 1941, and therefore allowed anyone to create and market their own versions of the product.
16 years feels like a weird number for something for like a patent, doesn't it? What do you think, a 5, a 10, a 15, 25, 20, something like that?
No, but maybe it was 15, and therefore...
And then in 41. Okay.
Maybe that's what they meant.
Yep.
By this.
Okay.
In 1940, a man named George Fox received the patent for a foam rubber pinboard that had cardboard backing.
Hmm.
In 1959, a man named W.F. Lewis issued a patent for a combined chalkboard and bulletin board. All right, which is one of the things we talked about before. In 1976, the concept of a bulletin board entered the information age when software developers Ward Christensen and Randy Seuss launched the first public dial-up bulletin board system. In 2006, they started creating high-resolution digital bulletin boards. Okay. In 2010, they had digital signage displays that were started, and they replaced bulletin boards as a means to reduce clutter and provide real-time information. And then 2010, you got Pinterest was created, which is more or less Pinterest. How do you pronounce that?
Pinterest.
There you go. So it's a content and photo sharing website meant to serve as an online personal bulletin board.
Oh, yeah. I haven't used that in forever.
Yeah. And then in 2017, General Enchantment was issued a utility patent for a physical electronic bulletin board system that includes a physical writing or pinning surface and an electronic display. So it's like a tablet computer that's capable of running digital signage software that augments the sharing of analog information with digital content. That's actually really cool.
It's cyclical. It's like we're going back to the beginning.
Yeah.
But digitally.
Yes.
That's really cool. I like when they first started introducing digital billboards on the highway because all of a sudden it could just change.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, cool. Because I remember it used to be like almost like a turn.
Right.
Like if it, say, it was all squares
They would have the, it would look like
like a stock ticker where it's like tick, 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 tick.
No, you had the stock ticker, but you also had the ones that look like blinds.
Yes.
Where they had like three sides to it or something and they would switch.
It would shift around.
I think they used that often in in baseball fields and stuff like that where they would shift around stuff like that. But, I mean, for me, what's really interesting is how does the advertising work that way? Because, back when you used to pay for the billboard, you'd probably pay for, the whole month. Here, you're sharing it with two other people or 10 other people. You know, I guess it has to say in the contract how many seconds it needs to be, displayed for before it switches.
And you got to think, too, because if you ever look at magazines and their ads, some companies are like, I don't want to be within 10 pages of an ad for cigarettes.
Right.
Or for drinking or for other stuff like that. So there's probably a lot. And I'm sure they're guaranteed, hey, every week you're going to be guaranteed, if it's 3 seconds per, 30,000 seconds worth of, whatever. One thing that does bother me there's a, when I head to work every day, I pass the Baltimore School for the Blind. One of their billboards has a pixel out on it, so the message will be crystal clear, but there's this one green little speck, and it bothers me so much.
You think it's done on purpose because it's for the blind?
No, but I think about that, though. Okay. Like, I really think about that, but I just think it's just a board that they need to replace that pixel.
Oh, wow. Okay, could be. So you should complain.
Yeah, but they got other more important things going on, I think, than, hey, we got to swap out a billboard.
Yeah, well, you know. No, actually, you should call the Institute of the Blind and tell them that there's a problem. But if that billboard switches, is the pixel on the other ones also off, or is it only when it shows that?
Interesting. No, it's off all the time. It's just that green little speck, no matter what's up there. Yeah,
it should
be
in all of them.
Yeah,
just like it's like a light bulb that went out. That, you know, like
exactly.
You got 1,000 light bulbs, and one of them went out.
Yeah,
and that's it.
Mm-mm-mm.
Yeah, seriously. And at this point, after John shows his hand with everything, who's around, who he knows and stuff like that, so Carl then interrupts. Thankfully, you know, Hans is not pushing on the button anymore, and he goes, how does he know so much about? And then Carl lifts up his hand and, mm-hmm. like, stops him from talking. You know, and as he's talking, so we get to see John, taking Heinrich's bag and opening it and start looking at stuff and whatever. And then Hans responds, that's very kind of you. I assume you are a mysterious party crasher. You are most troublesome for a security guard. So, what do you know about the term party crasher?
Just anybody that shows up uninvited to a party or a gathering, a social event.
You know any other terms that are used for it?
Mm.
There's one other term that's very prevalent that's used here.
The only other thing I can think of is party pooper, but that's someone that just ruins the social gathering.
It's a
stuff.
Gate crasher.
Why didn't I?
Right. It's the act of entering, attending, or participating in an event without an invitation or a ticket. The person doing the gate crashing is known as a gate crasher or a party crasher.
Mm-hmm.
Lots of times the motivation to do this is you want to avoid the entry fee. You want to gain access to free food, beverages, often alcoholic, party favors, gaining access to a private event, taking photos or videos of celebrities like paparazzi.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Okay, having photos or video taken with celebrities. You know, if you're there, you want to, ooh, there's Bruce Willis. I'll take a picture with him, you know, that type of thing. Or some people just do it for the thrill seeking.
The adrenaline.
The adrenaline, yeah. But sometimes people do it for nefarious reasons. There are crimes that people commit by being party crashers or gate crashers. Obviously, we're not condoning any of these crimes.
Mm-mm.
Don't do any of them. Could be for theft or looting. Could be for rape, fraud, murder, stalking, kidnapping, or just causing general disruption in order to gain some sort of attendance. Usually, when people do this, they try to blend in with the crowd. So John didn't really blend in with the terrorists here. Doesn't really work that way.
None of them are wearing tank tops.
You mean he's not wearing a tank top? He's wearing a white T-shirt. It's an undershirt. He's wearing an A shirt.
Well, it's now black. That's like a tank top.
It's now black because he has gone through the vent system.
That is true.
But and I got to say they colored it really well because it's perfectly colored all around.
Mm-hmm,
it's not. It doesn't have splotches. You'd think that it should have splotches.
No, it's designer.
Yeah. Exactly. Now, there was a book written in 1988 by a woman named Charlotte Laws, which is a how-to book on gate crashing, which is called Meet the Stars. So it details how she was able to crash dozens of celebrity events, major war shows, and even got past secret security to interview the president.
I'm sure that went really well.
She was even able to interview Elvis, which was reprinted as it entitled Uncle John's Bathroom Reader, and her memoirs, which are Undercover Debutante and Rebel in High Heels, explain some of her gate crashing escapades. So there's also the idea of wedding crashing.
Right. That's the whole movie.
That's right. You know, the act of attending a wedding celebration without an invitation, particularly when the person or persons who turn up have a profound impact.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so there are differently reasons why people would crash weddings too. Any ideas why people would do so?
Free food? Free drink? Oh, it's got to be free drink and then free food. Maybe even if it's nefarious, stealing gifts or money that happened to be on a table. Yeah. Or, again, the thrill.
Okay, great. So first is a lot of times a person, they want to see someone that they know, whether it's maybe it's their ex getting married or want to see a relative or friend, even if they weren't invited and they still want to show up there.
Right. They sometimes will come with someone who was invited.
You know, and but they themselves were...
They didn't get a plus one.
They didn't get a plus one or whatever it is, right? Sometimes they want something that's offered there, like you said, free food, free booze. It's not always cost-effective to do that. Because, you know, if you're going to a wedding, you have to dress up. So then you have to actually pay for, you know, for formal wedding clothes.
Attire, yeah.
In order
suits
to
and shoes.
To, yeah. I mean, in the Wedding Crashers, they had it already.
That's true.
Because it was something they were doing on a constant basis.
Mm-hmm.
It wasn't just a one-off, I guess you can say. You know, sometimes they want to steal money or gifts from the bride and groom. There's the thrill. Sometimes they want to try and win back the bride or groom, who was a former lover.
Oh.
Or a current romantic interest of the crasher.
The old-fashioned eye object.
Exactly. Like in The Graduate or mm-hmm. Wayne's World 2.
I love Wayne's World too.
Okay. Sometimes you do it just to get revenge.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you want to show the person up, the bride or groom. And at celebrity weddings, there is much crashing that occurs from those who wish to mingle with the celebrities or catch paparazzi photo shoots. There have been reports of celebrities crashing the wedding of strangers they encounter. That's really funny.
I like stuff like that, where they're just like walking through a hotel. They're like, oh, there's a wedding. They just pop in, take a picture with the bride and groom, and then off they walk. That's like a happy accident.
Yeah. Yeah. And then sometimes people crash weddings by accident, meaning that they were, you know, you're at a venue where there's multiple weddings, and mm-hmm. you just go to the wrong one.
Yeah. Yeah.
Oops. Oops. And it's not as if you're going to say, well, this one's got better food than the other one, because the odds are they're going to have the same menu. Or the same
very
basic
similar.
Menu.
Yeah.
Very similar. Yeah. And so basically, Hans calls him a security guard. Right? So when do you think the idea of a security guard, you know, started? How far back do you think that goes?
This one I'm going to go back into the BCs. Back when you had... You know, these emperors, and they had people watching the doors, or they had, like, borderline, like, what we would call now, like, secret service stuff for, like, presidents and things, but these are people that are, like, watching the doors, literally standing guard, traditionally guards, and then eventually, like, a security guard kind of thing. So I'm going to say in the BCs, like, 100 BC.
Okay, so this basically says that they don't have an exact date, but it goes back many, many centuries.
Yeah.
Based on exactly what you said. You know, sometimes a security guard can be known as a security inspector, security officer, protective agent. Okay, and the idea that sometimes they're referred to as watchmen.
Up in a watchtower. Maybe you a know. Sentry? Would they be known
it could
as
be.
A sentry?
Could be. Right, I mean, back in the Middle Ages, they had those where there was no real form of law enforcement, mm-hmm. but they still had someone who was in charge of, you know, guarding the gate of the castle and stuff like that, making sure that... You know, no gate crashers.
Nobody stealing treasures.
That's right. And so the most noteworthy person who was a security guard is a man named Frank Wills. Have you ever heard that name?
No, but I bet as you talk about it, it's going to... Is he the one? No. Yeah, tell me.
He was in 1972. Does that help a little bit?
72... Security guard in 72. No, because King and Kennedy were in the 60s. Both Kennedys were in the 60s.
No, it was in Washington, D.C.
Reagan wasn't until the 80s.
That's right. Reagan was 81.
That's the one I can think of is Reagan when the hell...
No, but I'm not talking about... No, I'm talking about security guard. I'm not talking about someone, you know, dealing with Secret Service or saving the president or anything.
Okay. Then no.
Just a famous security guard. No. So Frank Wills was the security guard in the Watergate office complex in Washington, D.C.
Okay.
And he's the one who actually noticed the tape covering the latch on the entrance to one of the buildings, thereby preventing it from locking And once he called the police, that's when they found that, you know, you had the five men who entered the Democratic National Committee headquarters in order to steal information for Nixon. Stuff. Okay. Then we also have another security guard named Christoph Mieli, who was a night guard at a Swiss bank, who became a whistleblower in 1997 when he told about the bank destroying records related to funds that were part of that were connected to Holocaust victims, whose money the bank was supposed to return to the victims' heirs, and instead decided to destroy all the records.
That is appalling.
Yes.
Ugh.
Yes. Now, a former child actor named Gary Coleman was also he worked as an armed security officer.
Yeah.
And he was allowed to use both a gun and a baton in L.A. And while shopping for a bullet-resistant vest for his job, he assaulted a female autograph collector. Coleman said he felt threatened by her insistence and punched her in the head.
I feel like I've heard about that one before.
Okay. And then the final one that I want to mention is Richard Jewell. Have you ever heard that name?
The 96 Olympics in Georgia.
That's right. That's right. He's the guy who...
they just did that movie about him.
Yes.
Yeah.
Clint Eastwood did it.
Yeah.
It was called Jewel, wasn't it?
I think it was.
Or maybe it was called Richard Jewel. I think maybe it was... I think it was both of his names. He's the guy who was accused of being the bomber, even though he actually tried to... He noticed... He found all the information and eventually was acquitted.
It was just called Richard Jewel.
Right, it was called Richard Jewel. Okay, that's what I thought. So, yeah, he actually saved hundreds of lives with what he did. And, you know, the movie shows it really well how, you know, people thought that... People really, dragged his name through the mud.
Yeah, which is just terrible. And yeah. I think they just wanted, like, an easy out. They didn't want to think about, you know, in foreign entities or terrorists or stuff like that. Like, they just wanted it to be just wrapped up with a bow.
Right.
That's such a bummer.
And... So Hans is basically trying to fish for information here from John, and John knows it, and he decides he's going to play along a little bit. So, you know, when he goes, "You're most troublesome for a security guard," and he goes, "Ah, sorry, Hans, wrong guess. Would you like to go for a double jeopardy where the scores can really change?"
And I love the confused look he gives.
Yeah.
Like, what are you talking about?
Yeah, exactly. Like, what? I'm not really sure what's going on here.
Yeah, that too. Like, who are you?
You know, I thought I was talking to some security guard or something. Who knows? So the sound of a buzzer, is an audio signaling device, which may be mechanical, electromechanical, or piezoelectric, which... are used for alarm devices, timers, trains, and the confirmation of a user input such as a mouse click or a keystroke and things like that. So the electric buzzer itself was invented in 1831 by a man named Joseph Henry, and it was mostly used for doorbells.
Makes sense.
Okay. And then the piezoelectric speaker, or a buzzer, it was invented by Japanese manufacturers in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
And what it's basically used for, it allows companies to be competitively cooperative and bring about several different innovations and inventions along the way, because it would be used in the buildings themselves.
Oh, okay.
Right. Then you have the mechanical, so that's like a joy buzzer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
You know, the
button, old handshake,
you
know, the buzzer.
Yeah. Right. So the way that a piezoelectric buzzer works, it's driven by an oscillating electronic circuit or another type of audio signal source. And what it does is the sounds commonly used to indicate that a button has been pressed with a click, a ring, or a beep, and things like that.
Yeah, it makes sense.
The way that... that works.
Yeah.
So what type of uses do you think people have for buzzers in modern society?
doorbells. When you now, like the office I work at, we have little key fobs that let us in and out. It's a beeping noise. It used to be a buzz, but then they, I don't know why they changed it, but now it's a beep to let us in and out of the building. So I'm just going to say mostly doorbells and security locks.
Okay. So it has, you can, they use them for novelty items. Okay. Judging panels.
Oh, yeah. Why didn't I even?
Okay. You didn't think of it. That's fine. Like, educational purposes. You know, I guess,
maybe like game maybe shows idea, within the.
No, maybe the idea is that it, that, you know, the end of a class.
Oh, like an inter. Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
That's
yeah.
what I would think. Yeah. That's what I would think there. Annunciator panels.
Oh, shot clocks for basketball.
Right. Electronic metronomes, game show lockout device, okay, microwave ovens or other household appliances.
I guess a little announcer.
The Bing, you know, sporting events, you know, like in basketball yeah. where you have
buzzer
the
buzzer beater.
The buzzer, yeah, yeah, there you go. Electrical alarms, and as we mentioned earlier, the joy buzzer.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, there's a lot of different uses for it, and apparently Hans isn't aware of any of those because of the look of shock on his face when John uses it. You know, and then at the same time as John is talking to him, you know, it's great how we see that he puts the phone down mm-hmm. and starts going through the bag, you know, going through Heinrich's bag as he's doing it, and he pulls out a pack of cigarettes mm-hmm. from Heinrich's shirt pocket, which doesn't look like a very comfortable place for him to keep it, but,
no.
you know, this movie does that often.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and then he goes, these are very bad for you.
Yeah.
You know, even though he takes them himself.
Yeah. And he's going to have them later.
Yeah. For sure. And then Hans looks at him and says, who are you then? So he's done playing games. Yeah. Hans. You know, before he was doing the guessing game, and at this mm-hmm. point he's saying, you know, I'm not going to guess anymore. Just, who are you? Tell me who you are. And John gives a great response. He goes, just a fly in the ointment, Hans. A monkey in a wrench. A pain in the ass.
The monkey in the wrench didn't make any sense to me, because I'm just used to the old, just the idea, like, monkey wrench. Like, not, I've thrown a wrench into it, okay. I'm not going to lie, I'm really glad, because I'm genuinely curious.
Okay, so there are a lot of different, first of all, we're going to go through all of them.
Yeah.
So we got fly in the ointment.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's an idiomatic expression for a drawback, especially one that was not at first apparent. For example, we have cook stove, beans, and plates. The fly in the ointment was the lack of a can opener. Okay, the phrase actually comes from the Bible.
Really?
Or the terminology, the source of the phrase.
Huh.
It's in Ecclesiastics, and it says, dead flies cause the ointment of the apothecary to send forth a stinking savor.
Okay.
All right.
Was not expecting that. I thought yeah. it might have been a Shakespeare thing.
So for many centuries, a fly in the ointment was meant as a small defect that spoils something valuable
mm-hmm.
or is the source of annoyance. Okay, that fits here now.
Yeah.
You yeah, know, absolutely. That's what it is. I'm the source of annoyance.
Yeah.
The modern version thus suggests that something unpleasant may come or has come to light in a proposition or condition that is almost too pleasing, that there is something wrong, hidden, unexpected somewhere. No, I think it still works that, you know, the source of annoyance.
Yeah.
I think that's what yeah. John's referring to here.
Absolutely.
Okay. So the monkey in the wrench is, as you said, very much connected to the idea of a monkey wrench.
Yeah.
To throw a monkey wrench into something.
Right.
Okay, so the original image was of throwing a monkey wrench into the cylinder of a threshing machine,
mm-hmm.
which would cause things to basically be fouled up.
Okay,
it is quite often used in political situations. That's the reference. You know that you know it means to stop or obstruct by direct interference.
Mm-hmm.
So again, that's you know. On the one hand, he's saying, I'm an annoyance, but I'm also here to stop you
yeah.
by what you're doing. Okay? So the earliest use of the phrase monkey in a wrench was in 1892 in the San Francisco Chronicle when
really?
There was a debate in the House of Representatives. And the quote is, Bland's action in insisting upon amending the steward bill has been severely criticized. He is charged with occupying the position of the man who threw a monkey in the wrench in the threshing machine because he was not allowed to feed it. The trouble with Bland seems to be that if Stewart's bill, that it is Stewart's bill and not his own. He wants all the fame, even if he jeopardizes the cause in which he proposes to lead.
Okay.
So, okay. You know, he's doing it just to foul things up, even though he himself agrees with the current situation. But that happens quite often in politics. You know, there isn't really nothing has changed in the
some people just
in
125
right. years or 130 years since this since that quote was started. Mm. Okay. Mm. And then we have pain in the ass,
mm-hmm.
which something or someone that causes discomfort or frustration. Again, you know, fits in perfectly here. You know, but it's great how they use all three of these phrases because each of them means something slightly different.
Yeah.
They're not exactly the same. He's not saying, okay, I'm this, I'm that, and the other thing, and they're all the same.
Mm-hmm.
They're, you know, the fact that John knows the difference, that there is a difference between them, says something also.
Yeah.
You know, it's amazing to listen to the way that he...
Yeah. There's like a weird, not a weird intelligence there, but there's a wit that you wouldn't really expect.
Yeah. Which, obviously, it means that somebody has done, their research here.
Mm-hmm.
More than us, you know, in order to make sure.
A little bit of due diligence.
The phrase is right there. Right? And then as he's, you know, as he's talking, he's taking stuff, he's looking at stuff in the bag, mm-hmm. in Heinrich's bag, and he pulls out, you know, all these detonators and C4 plastic explosives, and stuff like that. Now, the question is, do you think he knows what it all is? Do you think he realizes right away that these are explosives and a detonator?
I think in the
it bottles, might be written C4.
Yeah, I think he gets the C4 part, but I think the little plastic tubes, I don't think he realizes that those are the detonators for it.
Right.
But outside of that, I think that's when he realizes, like, whoa, like, well, this is serious now.
Right, they look like lipstick cases.
You know. They kind of do, don't they? A little plastic. They really do. And yeah. Then if you look at the C4 close enough, the date for it is February 14th, 1987. So in this case, if it's, you know, New Year's Eve, or excuse me, Christmas Eve 88.
Wait, you think that's the production date?
Yeah, that's the production date.
Production date. Made. Okay.
So the C4 is 10 months and 10 days old.
Cool.
Which is weird to think about.
Yeah. Yeah. Or, again, we've talked about that maybe this is a completely alternate universe where the days are different and this is not 1988 and whatever. Because the thing that doesn't make sense is in 1988, Christmas Eve was a Saturday night. So it doesn't make 100% sense that this should be taking place on Saturday night. Because why would they have their party on Christmas Eve? That's a question that we've asked so many times and we don't really have the answer. You know, most people want to be home with their families on Christmas Eve.
Especially on a Saturday.
Right. It's instead of being in the office for that. So you'd think that they would have the holiday party a few days before. But, those Japanese taskmasters. You know, but I guess Takagi's not going to be doing that next year.
Probably not. Probably, I think he might be a little preoccupied.
For the rest of his life.
Just a little bit.
He won't be joining us for the rest of his life.
I love that line.
So after he says that, as he's looking at the detonators and stuff like that, he says, whoa. And then there's a little bit of static on the CB. And at this point, Hans turns to Carl and says, check on all the others. Don't use the radio.
Mm-hmm.
See if he's lying about Marco and find out if anyone else is missing. So, I mean, it's great that he, you know, mentions the fact that right away he knows that, okay, for some reason he knows the guy's name is Marco,
mm-hmm.
that he's waxed, you know, and they have to figure out where to find him. How are they actually going to figure out where to find him? Because, you know, Heinrich told Marco to go down to the 34th floor.
Mm-hmm.
So they have to look for him on the 34th floor, but they ain't going to find him there.
No, because he's over in a parking lot somewhere else.
That's right. And as you mentioned earlier this week, he fell off the car.
Yeah.
You know, he's not down. He's not even, you know, next week, a little bit of a spoiler, it's going to say he's down on the street. But he's, you know, how would they know that? He's far away.
Yeah. This, unless they're looking out of windows. But if you look, they don't have any high-powered rifles with scopes. They're just kind of eyeballing stuff down right there.
Yeah, that line.
Well, he doesn't say that he threw them out, so obviously they're just going to go, hey, look for... But like you said, they're not going to find him because right, he's not there.
Correct. That's true. And they will find Heinrich there when they go to the 34th floor to try and find him. All right, so then that's pretty much how this minute ends. As, you know, then we see John looking back as if he's startled about something. Yeah. We don't know exactly what. And people will have to wait until Monday to find out what it is that he's startled about. You know, what has shocked John?
What's happening?
Who knows? And that's pretty much the end of this minute. Do you have anything else you want to say about the minute?
Yeah, what I really like about this minute is the four things when he's on, going on Heinrich's body there. He gets the cigarettes, which, spoilers, he later shares with right, Hans. There's the gun, which, again, spoilers, he later uses. The detonators, which they're chasing him around for.
Right.
Then, obviously, the C4, which it's going to get used later on for sure. So it's just one of those things, and we talked about it for the episode, just how many things come back around. Like, it's a combination foreshadowing, it's a combination just consistency and making sure it stays with it. But there's just so many little teeny tiny things that pay off either in big ways or little ways. And that's something, like, I can really appreciate more about this film because of those things.
Yeah, I mean, I remember when you were on The Great Escape, two seasons ago, you know, we had the whole thing where we found that the trumpet, was it?
The trombone. The still. Yeah. Because the one guy's looking for it, and it's like, well, here it is. It's part of there the still go. Now. And which, watching it, you don't really pay attention to it until you're paying attention to it. And like then all the stuff that's makes right. sense.
That's right. Cool. All right. So the script only has a few little minor discrepancies in the dialogue.
Okay. Okay.
John basically says, anyway, I thought you and Franco and Carl and the other boys might be lonely now that I waxed Tony and Marco and their buddy, so I invited some of the guys for my card game.
Okay.
Maybe he's referring to Powell? I don't know. It's a strange comment.
He can't be, though, because he's not talking to Powell yet.
No, but he's maybe saying that I brought the cops.
Okay.
Maybe that's what he's referring to here.
Okay, I can see that.
I'm not really sure. And at the point, and the only other discrepancy is at the end of the minute when Hans is talking to Carl, so John hears the static, and it says Hans goes back onto the CB. Meanwhile, McLean smiles at the telltale static as Hans goes off and on. He knows what's happening. Now he starts to walk down a corridor, eyes panning from elevator to the stairwell doors. Meaning that he knows, okay, they're planning to come for him at this point.
Yeah. That and I got him a little bit shook, because he doesn't have anything smart to say. He's trying to figure out what's actually going on.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's all we have here for this particular minute. So on Friday, we have a segment called Weekend Surprise, which you might know what it is or you might not know what it is if you've been listening to the show until now, because it's the same surprise every week. But basically, there has been much debate over the last 34 years about Die Hard. Mm-hmm. Is Die Hard considered a Christmas movie or not? And show your work. What do you think?
So I don't like the argument, because in my mind, it's not. However, rewatching it in preparation for this show, there are little things about it that make it more and more of a Christmas film. Obviously, the setting, obviously, the decorations, obviously, everybody's humming tunes. The score in the film has a lot of thematic Christmas carols that we know. And they use one over and over again. And of course, it's escaping my mind right now.
Let It Snow. Oh, wait, you're talking about the Ode to Joy?
That one.
Okay,
Ode to Joy. Which I kind of see as more of like a Christmas song than other ones for some reason. But there's just something, like, when it's, like, dour and there's, you know, we're looking at Gruber and his character, all of a sudden it's just a cello that comes in with it. But during other parts, it's a little brighter, it's a little more pronounced in, like, a positive way. So it's just interesting to hear, like, the score pulls at that theme and keeps putting it into the movie. I can't remember, it's some Christmas song, but the name of it is escaping me right now. But it's right there, and it's just, it's hitting you with a cello, and it's, yeah.
Okay, now do you know, I know that you're a Kubrick fan,
mm-hmm.
So what other movie uses the same type of...
It's the, Clockwork Orange.
Yes.
Because that's the one that Alex really likes, and he loves it, and then eventually it makes him sick.
Yes. Isn't that great that there's that connection between them?
It's little winks and nods. Like, you know, a lot of action films when they throw the Wilhelm scream in there.
Yeah.
Little stuff like that, which I like. Or Pixar, they
all
have.
Oh, you think this is a wink and nod because of the fact... I mean, this is the main theme in this movie.
I don't think it is, but I think in other films it might be like a wink and nod kind of thing.
Right.
But there's just something about having that score in there that just...
Right. So, I mean, it's called Ode to Joy, and it's also... The official term is the Symphony Number 9 in D.
Mm-hmm.
Choral... OP 125. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's Opera 125 or something like that. And, so they have that in Clockwork Orange also, mm-hmm. which is, you know, you and I were talking earlier about Kubrick.
Yeah.
You know, before we were recording, and, you know, it's just very apropos.
Very much so.
That it fits in here.
It's just all these coincidences, man. All these coincidences.
It's more than coincidences.
Yeah, no, absolutely.
They're not just random coincidences.
It can't be. If it's too many, it can't be.
Yeah, especially, you know, we randomly chose the week right before your birthday.
Yeah.
And your birthday falls out on a weekend, so it's not as if, you know, we could have recorded on your birthday. We're recording as close to your birthday without going over.
Yeah.
You know, it's like Price is Right.
Yeah,
you know,
exactly.
How much is it without going over? And, you know, because if it would have been next week, then Monday, it's already past your birthday.
Yeah, so. And I'd be probably a little groggy and tired. Or all hyped from all the sugar I've been eating because of the cake.
That could be. Anything's possible. We'll never know.
Yeah.
We'll never know. This way, you'll have the time and, you know, to have all that sugar high if you really want to. All right, well, Nick, you want to, for one last time, tell people how they can get in touch with you?
Yeah, one last time, at the Rehack, T-H-E-R-E-H-A-K. I'm also over on Mixcloud.com with Rehack Radio. Like I said, it's about an hour long. It's me. I'm bringing out some music. We're talking about the music, fun facts, stories behind it, talking about the bands. It's a really good time. I enjoy doing it, and I hope you enjoy listening to it.
Yeah, I hope so. I hope everyone does, too.
Be funny if they didn't. Like, why would you keep plugging this? It's not good.
No, it's good, it's good, it's good. Go there, listen to it. And finding me is quite simple. Just do a quick search for Move Around Minute. You can find me on Facebook, you can find me on Twitter, or you can go directly to my website. So, Nick, once again, I want to thank you for hosting me this week and for being my guest at the same time.
Yeah, you know, and vice versa.
It's been fun. Exactly. It's been very fun being here in Baltimore all week. You know, in 2 weeks, we'll have another... remote location show.
Awesome.
We'll be in New Jersey.
There you go.
You know, but...
staying coastal.
Yeah, but, you know, next week we'll be back in Israel. So, you know, it's jumping around.
A little bit.
Here and there. But, yeah, it's been fun having you. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much for having me. Yeah.
Yeah. And until Monday, yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay. Happy birthday.
Oh, yeah. Happy birthday to Nick, too. Forgot about that part. Yeah. Have a happy yippee-ki-yay birthday.
There we go. Perfect.
All right. See you all on Monday. Yippee-ki-yay.
Yippee-ki-yay.